What is going on, everybody? Welcome to Inventing the Future. Our mission with the show is to introduce you to the entrepreneurs and ideas that will inspire and empower you to solve the world's biggest problems. This is Julian Alvarez, and I'm a co-founder and the CEO at Mindflow, which is a learn-to-earn platform, and a software engineer at Meta. Today, we are speaking with Kian Gohar. So Kian inspires the world's leading organizations to harness innovations and moonshots to solve complex problems. He's the founder of Geolab, which is an innovation research and training firm that empowers leaders through coaching, strategy, and design. Previously, he was an executive director of the XPRIZE Foundation, designing moonshot challenges to solve pressing global problems through partnerships with corporations, foundations, and governments. And he was also on the faculty of Singularity University, where he taught exponential thinking to thousands of entrepreneurs and executives. Kian has coached the leadership teams of dozens of Fortune 500 companies and is a sought-after public speaker on innovation. He's a graduate of Northwestern, the London School of Economics, and Harvard Business School. And most recently, he is now the co-author of a book named Competing in the New World of Work with Keith Ferrazzi. So they just published their book 2 days ago on February 15th. And this book highlights the future of work by providing research-based insights and best practices for leading change in the ever-evolving post-pandemic world of work. So we'll be taking a deep dive into some of the core ideas from the book in this episode and really explore questions such as, what does the future of work look like? And what are the four key leadership principles that you can leverage to thrive in this new world? And how can we become more adaptable in a world where the only constant is change? So with that, let's go ahead and dive into the conversation with Kian. All right, welcome back, everyone, to another episode. I have Kian here with me. Welcome to the show, Kian. How you doing today, man?
Doing well, thanks, Julian. Happy to be here.
Great, awesome. So Kian, to start off, I would love to hear a little bit more about your story and how you got into this world of exponential technologies, entrepreneurship, and why you decided to make this absolutely ridiculous decision to become an entrepreneur.
I wish somebody had told me 20 years ago that entrepreneurship is not a career, but rather it is a journey. That would have made the decision a lot easier. I've been in entrepreneurship innovation pretty much my entire career. Coming out of grad school, I joined a early stage venture capital fund in London, and then I joined the first ever Chinese venture fund. And then I decided in order to be a really successful entrepreneur, instead of just being an investor, you really had to be on the operating side of the table. And so after business school, I joined a very interesting startup in South Florida, which was making kitesurfing equipment. And most people would think, well, that's not a very interesting niche, but it was the fastest growing sport in the world for about 5 years. And I joined this company called Pure Action Sports, and it totally disrupted how sporting goods was shipped and built and sent all across the world. And so we were very disruptive back in 2005. We were on the cloud before the cloud was even a thing. We had a distributed hybrid workforce. And so it was a really amazing rocket ride to be part of that startup for about 5 years. I was the chief operating officer. We ended up really working with companies in 100 different countries, getting our sporting goods equipment to places that I'd never even heard of and meeting people I'd never even interacted with. And it was just really an incredible ride. And I took a sabbatical and I went to Africa for about 6 months because I really wanted to figure out what was the next thing that I really wanted to build, because I'm really interested in intersection of impact and passion and entrepreneurship. And when I was there, my father passed away accidentally and I moved back to LA unexpectedly. And while I was here, I was trying to figure out what the next thing to build was. And I ended up meeting Peter Diamandis, who is the founder of the XPRIZE Foundation. And we just got along like a house on fire. And so I ended up joining the XPRIZE and Peter to build a new innovation ecosystem for Fortune 500 companies in Silicon Valley in partnership with Singularity University. And so I did that for the next 6 years. And for all those years, I had just such an incredible opportunity to not only learn from the best of the best in technology in Silicon Valley, but really get to know people on a very personal level. And people always ask, how does the world of kiteboarding translate to the world of Silicon Valley and like this disruptive tech? And there are some overlaps in terms of people, in terms of lifestyles. But I would just say, as I said earlier, entrepreneurship really is a journey. It's not a career path, and you don't know where one step goes to the next. And so as long as you're open to learning and pivoting and working with people who you really admire and who are going to change the world, you're going to open yourself up to a lot of opportunities. So that's sort of my journey over the last 20 years of my career in entrepreneurship and innovation. And it's been a journey, and I'm so excited for what the next 20 years is.
Yeah, that's awesome. What a crazy pivot to go from the kite surfing and boarding to where you are now. But I love that. It's more of a journey than a career. And the key thing there is the openness, as you mentioned. Kian, one of the things you mentioned is you were looking for like the next thing to build. You have like this building mentality. And one thing I'm curious about is like, why do you think you're wired this way? Like many people wouldn't naturally think of like what to build next or what to do next. So where does that come from for you?
You know, it's a great question. I'll say that I've never had a job that I've ever applied for. I've always created my own opportunity, whether that is creating a new role at an established company or going to build something new. It's just been the way I am. I was born in Iran, and we left Iran when I was very young and immigrated to the US as refugees. And so early on, I think I was wired in a way to you just have to hustle and survive and thrive in a new environment. And I realized I'm actually really good at thriving in uncertainty and in places that I haven't really gotten to know very well. And so that was one of the reasons why I moved to China 20 years ago and worked for the first ever Chinese venture fund, speaking almost no Chinese. And so I think I've always really thrived in places that have the gray zone between what is certain in black and white and sort of where the rest of the world is. And I've never really found it appealing to go work for an established company that has an established role, because that's more in the black and white, and I tend to do really well in the gray.
Yeah, interesting. Always an interesting experiment to go beyond and question why you do certain things. But great, man. And so then it sounds like you made this opportunistic encounter with Peter Diamandis. I very much admire Peter. I'm part of Abundance 360 as well. So yeah, would love to hear more about what that interaction was like, how that led to XPRIZE and then Singularity and that part of the story.
So I met Peter through a mutual friend and a mutual friend of his, and they were interviewing for a new job, a new spinoff from the XPRIZE, and it was a CEO for the startup. And I thought it was a really interesting opportunity, and I presented this whole research of what I thought the startup should do in front of the board of the startup, and I ended up not getting that offer, which was fine, because 5 days later, Peter called me and said, hey, I really liked your energy. Even though it didn't work out particularly for this particular opportunity, I want to talk to you about what other opportunities may exist and how we can collaborate together. And so that was the very beginning of our conversation. It was 10 years ago, and we're still friends. I just saw him yesterday. And so it's been a phenomenal journey. I'm very deeply appreciative of all that I've learned from him and our collaboration. And happy to go into some of those stories. But what I loved working with Peter for so long was that his can-do attitude, and that really nothing is impossible to accomplish. And that is just an incredibly inspiring story. And trying to figure out how do you take that into your own life and make your impossible possible is a beautiful perspective for every young person.
Yeah. Reminds me of a quote Tony Robbins says, where he says that impossible is an opinion. And I think Peter can definitely resonate with that in what you're saying right now.
Absolutely. Some things might be more difficult than others. And so we can agree that there is a range of possibility. And so focus on the ones that are going to be transformative for your own life.
Definitely. Yeah. And I would say, obviously, that's not completely realistic, but it's more of a mindset. And the mindset is often what makes all the difference in just creating that sense of possibility in your mind so that you can expand into the opportunity and be aware of the opportunity that exists in front of you. So yeah. But yeah, and then also focusing on highest impact. And actually, I'm curious, how do you think about that when it comes to like all these problems that exist around the world and all these opportunities? What is your filter or frame of thinking for identifying the most impactful things or the things you're most interested in working on?
Well, I think there's so many problems that an entrepreneur can go solve, from building something in retail to go solving a grand global challenge around food safety or water abundance or building the new deep tech application. There's so many things one can choose to spend their time to really build. The one thing that we all have in common is that we have one minimizing resource, and that is time. We never will get time back. So I like to think about what is the most impactful work that I can do given the limited amount of time that I have. And so when I talk to entrepreneurs and they say, what should I do? What's my next step? I say, you know, try to figure out exactly what do you want to learn in this next phase of your chapter before the next chapter, and what's going to be the best use of your time. Now, you're going to be particularly interested in some things that may not necessarily have a business application. For example, you might be passionate about history and you might not necessarily see that as a business opportunity, but that's where your passion lies. Well, that's great, but that doesn't necessarily correlate with the needs of the world. So you have to find the intersection of where your passion lies and where the world has a need to solve a problem for. And that Venn diagram, that overlap, is sort of like where you should be focusing your time on, so that you wake up every morning and you feel like you're really still trying to solve the problem that moves the world forward. But you also see this as not a job, but as a calling. So you really have to find that intersection between what really drives you and what the world needs, and then focus on that particular area.
Yeah, and that's not easy to find at all, but it makes all the difference when you do find it. And actually, Gary Bowles talks about this similarly, where he says that the ideal work you should do lies at the intersection of what you mentioned, like work that the world needs, like solving a big problem, something you're very passionate about, but also something that you're good at, and also something that can pay you well, are two additional factors that can also be things to consider as well in that journey.
I think that's great. And I know Gary from our work together in the past. And I think this just kind of reinforces the message that I had earlier, that entrepreneurship is not a career, it's a journey. And there will be times where entrepreneurship may seem mysterious and may not be clear as to what your next path is. And that's fine. The sooner you accept that, the less frustrating it'll be, because unlike traditional corporate work or in any other kind of profession where there is a step ladder to what you do next, there is no step ladder in entrepreneurship. It's not a vertical thing. It's sort of orthogonal. It goes in many different kinds of directions. And so thinking about that, you're trying to solve for what you're really good at, what pays, what the world needs, and what you're passionate about. Those are four things that it's oftentimes difficult to find the overlapping Venn diagram. And you might be searching for a while within a chapter of your career. And so just remember that it's not a stepladder. It is very orthogonal. And the sooner you accept that entrepreneurship is a journey rather than a career, that'll help you step back and say, okay, maybe at this particular chapter of my career, my life, I need something that's a little more linear, but I'll come back to it at a future point. So it is an absolute journey. It's a beautiful journey, so long as you accept the risks and rewards and the challenges.
Yeah, I love that way of framing it and being very thoughtful of when I'm going to be linear versus orthogonal. That's why I also believe that probably the most important skill you can develop in life that also directly connects with what you're saying is to become comfortable with discomfort, because especially in entrepreneurship and in life, there's no clear-cut linear path. So you got to be okay with that and learn how to navigate the uncertainty.
We live in very uncertain times. And I think part of the challenge that people have been very stressed out about over the last couple of years is that the level of uncertainty, or finance people would call the beta in the market, has gone up dramatically. And so a lot of people aren't comfortable with uncertainty. And that's okay. They just have different priorities and approaches to life. And so for them, living in uncertainty is really difficult. But for an entrepreneur, it's just how we're wired. And it may lead to more gray hairs, but that is just the way we think. And if you're able to live in a world that uncertainty is a paradigm, which I believe will be the case going forward, that sets you up for success.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, on that topic, I think we can both agree that we live in a world where the only constant is change, and that change itself is accelerating, which kind of demands like so many things of people. I'm curious, like, how can people constantly get in the habit of disrupting themselves and preparing for this new exponential age?
So I think the pandemic accelerated a lot of the trends that we had been seeing for the better part of the last decade. I've been talking about technologies like AI and automation are going to disrupt so many different kinds of work. And we saw in the pandemic that everything became incredibly digital and virtual almost overnight. And so it really accelerated a lot of those trends. To your question of how do we think about becoming comfortable in the uncertainty, one of the things I do that's really important for me is I need to go see new places. I've traveled to over 100 different countries, from Cuba to North Korea to Iran to you name it. For me, the travel is not necessarily a go and sit at a nice resort and take the nice selfie, but it's really a way for me to expand my mindset and to see new things. I think entrepreneurs and people who want to be comfortable in uncertainty have to get in the habit of seeing new things. Now, I'm not suggesting you need to go on a worldwide expedition to do that, but even in your own neighborhood, you probably are taking the same exact path between the grocery store and your house. And it's probably down the same street you've been going down for the last 6 months, year, whatever, however long you've been living in that community. How do you train your mind to go down different paths and see new things, new parts of your neighborhood that you hadn't previously seen before, walk down different streets, to really be able to think about what is it that I'm not seeing that I really should be thinking about? And so for me, what gets me really excited about travel and about seeing different places, it rewires my mind for what's possible. And so you can do that on an everyday level in the community that you live in, just to take a different path home from wherever you're going and see something new. That is a really easy step to start thinking about the world that is totally there, but you're not seeing.
Yeah, no, it's so important. And from all the entrepreneurs I've been speaking to on this podcast, travel is a common denominator of things that not only open their mind, but oftentimes it's where they discover the problems that lead to the startups that they're currently in. And it's just so fascinating to see how the same human lives in so many different ways. It kind of, the contrast helps you question your beliefs, your way of life, your culture, your faith, whatever it is. And I think it's a healthy skepticism to put in your life in order to keep on thinking how you can live better for who you are and what you want.
Absolutely. I think as humans, our amygdala was designed way back hundreds of thousands of years and tens of thousands of years ago to help us think about flight or fight, right? And so we have this biology to naturally want to either do one or the other. But the amygdala isn't always on. Oftentimes, it's only thinking about fight or flight when it's an emergency. Most of the time, the brain just shuts down around that particular part of the neocortex. And so then the brain wants to use less energy to be able to actually live effectively. So your brain creates these constructs, what we call assumptions. And so we do that on a daily basis. We're assuming this. We're assuming that. I want to have the safety of this. And so if you are constantly living in a world of assumptions in your head, that creates the space for you to not think differently because you have this particular construct. And only when your amygdala is all of a sudden highlighted through a particular crisis will your brain then say, wait a second, is that assumption that I made correct or not? And so we like to live in the world of certainty and assumptions because our brain is wired that way. And so you oftentimes have to actually reconstruct how you live in order to be able to test those assumptions as an entrepreneur on a daily basis. And for me, part of that is going to see different neighborhoods and seeing different things because I'm constantly testing my assumptions of what is valid and what is not.
I love that connection to it of part of the exploration and traveling and taking just a different path in your daily commute can make all the difference in testing and invalidating or invalidating assumptions. And one of my core philosophies for entrepreneurship is that assumptions are really freaking dangerous. So make sure you clarify what you do and don't know for certain and go out and test it and experiment. But cool. I want to touch on two things here. Your startup and your company Geolab, as well as the new book that you're writing. So let's start off really quick with Geolab. And if you could give us an overview of what you guys do, why you do it, and the problem you're aiming to solve with Geolab.
Yeah, so Geolab is an innovation research and training firm. So we do research on future models of change, and we help organizations and corporations and governments think about what future states can look like. And then we help them design roadmaps of how to build an ecosystem, whether internally at a company or externally within a larger context or society to get to that state. So we do that kind of research, and then we deliver that context in terms of leadership and development training, specifically around innovation and technology disruption. So that's sort of the context for Geolab. When the pandemic arrived in 2020, I'm confused because this is my second pandemic, actually. I lived in China in 2002, 2003 during the first pandemic I went through, which was SARS. And so I have a little bit of experience what it's like to live in pandemic life before most other Americans. And so I get confused about which pandemic year am I talking about. So when the COVID pandemic arrived in 2020, we were trying to figure out how is the world of business going to change. And we're a research and training organization. So we started this massive research project with my dear friend, Keith Ferrazzi, who I've known for a decade, and we've collaborated a lot together in other contexts. And I've had him speak at a variety of my conferences at Singularity University and the XPRIZE. And we got together and we said, you know, how is the world of business going to change? This is not going to go away in 2 weeks when everybody thought, we'll just stay home for 2 weeks. But it was radically changing how people had to work virtually and remotely. And I said earlier that these trends just accelerated exponentially in the first 3 months of the pandemic of 2020. And so we were trying to figure out, how do you work remotely? How do you use these new digital tools? And the reality is, many large corporations, even though they are aware of these technologies that are disruptive and changing the world, they are at different parts of their continuum as to how well they have incorporated those technologies and built that into their culture of everyday work. And so everybody all of a sudden had to do that, and they were scrambling. So we, as a research organization, wanted to better understand what they were doing, what were the key lessons and learnings that we could help take from the best of the best, and then translate that to other organizations who were, let's say, a little further behind in their continuum journey of transformation. And then all of a sudden, in the summer of 2020, we also had the massive issues of racial equity and the summer of racial protests. And so then we have to start thinking about, well, what does that mean in terms of inclusion? How are people really being heard? So this led to this massive research project that we did for 18 months in collaboration with Harvard Business School, Salesforce, Dell, and a bunch of other companies who funded this research, for us to really understand what were the key traits that the teams that were most successful in the pandemic era of disruption, what did they do, and how could you learn from that and be able to emulate the best of the best? And on the heels of that, we wrote this book, which is being published by Harvard Business Review. It's called Competing in the New World of Work. And our whole thesis is that you can't go back to work. That world has gone. There is a new era that has arrived and has different characteristics and different requirements for leadership competencies. And through our research, we were able to identify and pattern match four particular leadership skill sets that were common across 2,000 different top executives that we interviewed and entrepreneurs, to be able to highlight what are these four key leadership competencies and then how can you learn them. And so that's been the major research project we've done for the last 2 years since the beginning of the COVID pandemic. We are thrilled with this book coming out very soon. And we do hope that it creates an opportunity to have a roadmap for any team at any organization, whether you're young or whether you're older or established, to really be able to learn these key lessons so that you can outcompete your competition and build unstoppable teams.
Yeah, I love that. That's awesome how your work with Geolab directly connected to the writing of this new book, and I guess super, super relevant for where we are today with the pandemic and this new world. Yeah, so I'd love if you could dive a little bit more into that. For example, telling us like these four key leadership characteristics, as well as how these might apply to entrepreneurs and startups today.
Yeah, awesome. So I mentioned that we interviewed over 2,000 executives, entrepreneurs, change makers, leaders all across the world to better understand sort of like, what did they do over the last 2 years, especially during the first crisis year of the pandemic, to really be able to pivot and shift and innovate. And so we pattern matched that into four leadership competencies. And by themselves, they may not sound radically new, but actually being able to do all four of them really well puts you in this flow state, which we call being radically adaptable. And so you asked me earlier, how can people learn to thrive in uncertainty? And we believe that if you're able to really develop this muscle for radical adaptability, which is compromised with these four leadership lessons, you're able to go into any situation in the future and be able to thrive without knowing what exactly will happen. And so by themselves, each of these four leadership traits are not revolutionary, but doing them well and doing all four of them well is really what distinguishes the best from the rest. So these four are collaboration. The second one is agility. The third one is resilience. And the fourth one is foresight. And so I'll go into each of them just a little bit. In the world of collaboration, we suddenly had to work in very different ways, not in the office anymore, but virtually using digital tools and formats that we previously weren't comfortable with. And the reality is that we learned in the pandemic that it's not where you work that matters, it's how you show up to work that matters. And so the best of the best teams of the pandemic era were able to really maximize collaboration using tools to crowdsource ideas and bring in voices from many different parts of the organization and from external partners as well, from vendors, supply chain, from mentors and coaches. And so historically, companies work within the confines of a building or an office. And so the people you see and you collaborate with are your teammates who are sitting at the desk with you or the cafeteria with you. And that's just how it's always been. But the reality of the pandemic was that we were able to collaborate effectively with people that we weren't even close to. So instead of having to rely on your colleagues in Silicon Valley, now you could talk to people in the Philippines and work with them effectively. And this was the norm. We at Geolab have a virtual team. And so our team works completely collaboratively in a very effective way across the entire world. And so how do you do that? It's easy to say, let's collaborate. But there are different kinds of tools that you can use to really maximize this conversation and the effectiveness of being able to make sure everybody is being heard, first of all, and is also contributing their ideas that could open up new pathways for you to think about solving a problem. The big myth about innovation and collaboration is that you have to be in the same room to whiteboard things. Well, that's just not true anymore. There are so many ways that you can do the exact same kind of thing in a collaborative environment virtually. And so the best of the best were able to use these kinds of tools, A, to bring in different voices from many different parts of the company and outside the company to ideate new perspectives. And the second thing that collaboration really allowed for was to really create a psychologically safe space for people of all different kinds of backgrounds within an organization to feel that they had a place where their voice can be heard. So everybody's familiar with using Zoom. You have, a Zoom town hall with, let's say, your startup of 50 people or your very large company of thousands of people. You have like an all company broadcast. So that's one way that people use Zoom. The more effective way of using it is actually to go into breakout rooms and very small breakout rooms of three people or four people, at the very most, to have conversations and an intimate space where everybody can have this dialogue. So there are different kinds of tools that you can use to maximize collaboration and inclusion and radically shift innovation. So that is like the first leadership characteristic that I think every company needs to be a master of. And what we're seeing now is people have been saying for the last, year now, oh, we can't wait to go back to work. Well, people thought they'd go back to work summer of last year after the first round of vaccines. And then the Delta strain came and we said, oh, well, we'll wait till September. And then September, October came and then Omicron hit. And they're like, oh, we'll wait till January. The reality is we will never go back to work. We were only going to go forward to work. And so the era of the way we used to do things has gone. And the sooner that an entrepreneur or a leader is able to accept that, the sooner you'll be able to move into this new paradigm, which requires you to use these kinds of collaborative tools that are just the new norm in this era.
Yeah, really fascinating. Zoom, of course, is a powerful tool that kind of people were forced to adopt. But what other tools have you seen other people using to enhance collaboration and inclusion?
So digital whiteboards, a company called Mural, M-U-R-A-L, which is a digital whiteboard software. We use that all the time at Geolab and with my co-author, Keith Ferrazzi, at his firm, Ferrazzi Greenlight. It's a great way to collaborate instead of actually feeling like you have to be on a physical whiteboard. It's literally a digital whiteboard and you can add stickies and you can draw things and you can collaborate. And our team does this between the Philippines and California and Boston. So it doesn't really matter where you are anymore. And that's a great tool. So there are many different kinds of tools. If you're not already using all the technology, the communication technologies like Slack, et cetera. I mean, those are all obvious ways to do. Here's one other thing I'll say. There is something to be said for being a little bit analog. And if you have all these tools that you're using, it can be very, very effective. But sometimes the one thing that the world of virtual work does not have versus in-office work is that if you remember working in the office, you'd walk by somebody's desk or somebody's office and you'd say, hi, how's it going? You might talk to them for like 2 or 3 minutes and about something tangential. And then all of a sudden that might spark an idea about a particular project that you were working on and that might open up a conversation. That doesn't happen as much in the virtual world because everything is either asynchronous in terms of how we collaborate or it's on Zoom or it's on, some other software platform. I think there is a benefit to having those kinds of purposeful, accidental interactions with your colleagues that you used to have by running into them in the hallway or et cetera. And how do you do that? You should create a culture, whether you're a startup or whether you're a larger company, to interrupt other people's time and feel free to call them on the phone. Very simple. You could say, hey, I have this quick question. Do you have 2 or 3 minutes to answer me or talk about this? And instead of trying to schedule it on your calendar to talk, there should be a culture where you should feel comfortable calling somebody, asking them a question. And if they're not available, they just don't answer. It's very simple. But creating purposeful accidental interactions like we used to have in the real world, I think is really critical in this digital world. So as many of these amazing new digital tools exist for collaboration, sometimes adding a little bit of analog goes a long way.
Love that. Great tip. And it's very simple and easy to do, but it's more so the intentionality and the permissibility of it getting used to. And one thing I found works well as well is like for the startup, having like a work meeting, say like a 2-4 hour period, you don't have to talk or meet, but rather there's the space. And if anyone wants to jump in, say anything or whatever, the space is there. So just creating the space and the environment, I think is really important as well, even in a digital context.
Absolutely. And setting the tone from the leadership team that this is the kind of expectation that we have. So let me just say a little bit more around collaboration. When in a crisis hits, it's very normal for you to say, okay, Julian, you go do this, I go do this, because we have limited time and we're just kind of like panic, like, let's just get it done. We create this contract. We say, okay, let's go do this, and then we'll meet again tomorrow or later today, and then we'll get it done. In the quote-unquote real world, non-crisis world, we don't have social contracts of how we behave. And so I think it's really critical when we're thinking about collaboration, maximizing collaboration, is to think that we're really trying to co-create together and co-elevate, as my co-author Keith Rossi likes to say, to lift everybody up, to be able to accomplish everything together so that we as a team are crossing the finish line together. And part of that requires you to create a social contract within your team. Again, doesn't matter if you're a startup or a large company, small or big, what is the expected behavior that you want people on the team to demonstrate to be able to solve the problem together? And having this kind of recontracting process, I think, is really critical, especially as we are coming out, quote unquote, coming out of this pandemic to this new world of work. What is this new social contract that you expect your teams to have to be able to work together? And in that kind of conversation, that's a great space for an entrepreneur as the founder, as the leader or larger organization to say, my expectation is that we have the ability to interrupt each other in our days and create this opportunity to talk to each other and call each other. So it's really critical to recontract what that social experience looks like coming out of this era.
Yeah, man, I love that. All right, before we move into agility, I'm going to highlight one quick thing. And it's that really like what you have to do is think about like the culture, and the culture really is a system of how people interact and the behaviors behind it. And the term I love that you use is social contract. The social contract kind of being like, what is like the way in which we should interact, or what behavior should we kind of enable and create in this culture? And the social contract is almost like the individual smaller pieces of which the higher level system of the culture and the organization is built out of. So if you want to build a culture, especially centered around collaboration, think a lot of what are the right social contracts that you want to have for your company in order to create that higher level vision you want to have.
Absolutely. Culture is just a set of behaviors, nothing else. And so if you change people's behaviors, you're going to change the culture. And so if you're a startup, you're trying to create a new culture, then a great way to do that is to set aside time to figure out what are the expected social behaviors and the social contract that we want to have as a team to be able to really manage effectively. So that's a great point.
Yeah, love that. Super cool. All right, let's go into agility.
So agility is, it's probably of the four leadership characteristics, the one that comes most naturally to startups and entrepreneurs rather than to larger established organizations. Larger established organizations have large processes. It takes them sometimes a lot of time, a lot of resources to be able to really accomplish a project. And there's a lot of hierarchy and a lot of office politics, and that's just the way it is. And so they struggle with agility. Entrepreneurs and startups less so, because they know that they have limited resources. They have a limited runway to accomplish something before their funding runs out or before they need to release a demo or approve a product to a potential partner. So they realize what the importance of what it means to be agile. And so oftentimes startups, at least software startups, really run it in an agile format, means developing software or doing it in a way where you're constantly meeting every single day with your team and you're running a sprint, usually a very short designated time period, let's say 2 weeks, that allows you to make incremental progress towards a much larger vision. So you have this vision to deliver this new product in 6 months' time. How do you actually break that down into manageable chunks over many different kinds of sprints to be able to then be able to actually get something accomplished? And the idea of doing this is pushing down responsibility to every single person at the team level, to them that they can be empowered to get things done, and that they come to the daily stand up and say, hey, if I'm having a problem with this today, I don't know how to do this, somebody else on the team can say, well, I know this particular solution that you can use to unblock you and be able to move you forward to solving that particular goal on that sprint. I think this comes naturally to startups, maybe not necessarily the exact same framework or methodology, but we as entrepreneurs and founders have to figure out, where do we spend our time and what problem do we solve for first? You know, in Silicon Valley, we say solve the hard problems first. And I love sharing this example. It's called monkey first. What if you had to teach a monkey to stand on top of a pedestal and recite Shakespeare? Which part do you solve first? Now, it's natural to say, oh, I'm going to go build a pedestal because then I can show to my boss that I'm making progress. But the reality is that's pretty easy to do. The hardest part of solving that problem is that you'll never be able to teach a monkey to recite Shakespeare. And so if you can't do that, then don't do the entire project because it's not going to be successful. And so as an entrepreneur, I think you have to decide, I have limited resources. How do I go solve the most important problem first and be able to tackle that? And I think entrepreneurs are typically better at this than executives are. And so they're naturally inclined to say, okay, we got to solve this problem this week. This is really urgent. And the three of you on this team are tasked on solving it in the next 3 days. That's typically not how larger organizations think. They're just much more methodical and process oriented. They're really geared for efficiency rather than for innovation and disruption. And that there's a, you know, a whole history of why that is. And so of these four leadership characteristics, I think entrepreneurs are really good at taking these kinds of agile experiments that move them constantly forward to that next step. And if they're not good at it, then they're probably not going to be entrepreneurs.
Yeah, no, that's great. You know, I want to push back a little bit on the notion of solving the hardest problem first. I agree that's like the most important thing because you have to prove you can even do that. My skepticism is that if you aim to go to the hardest problem and maybe you don't have a lot of experience or a lot of insight or a great team, then it may be easier to start off with like an adjacent problem to the big problem and start solving that so you can get like validity. You can say like, okay, we've got some traction, momentum, and build on top of that so that then you can go to the larger problem.
I agree. I think there's two ways to do it. And again, if going back to the teaching the monkey how to recite Shakespeare, you'll never be able to incrementally get there, right? And so no matter how hard you try, it's just not going to happen. And so if you recognize that that's the hardest problem to solve, you have to make a decision. We can't do that, then that's not a problem to solve. We're going to go do something else, right? And so the idea is to identify what the hardest assumption is and what the hardest problem is. Maybe not solve for it right away, because like you said, you may not have the resources, you may not have the team, and so you want to work your way to that. But if that ultimate goal isn't literally impossible to achieve, then that's not a goal that you should be spending your time on.
Yeah. No, well said. Yeah. It's more so the core idea of, can we solve this in the long run? Is this even possible? And how can we build up to it if so?
Yes.
So like that. All right, cool. Resilience.
So resilience, I mean, what we found in our research is that 40% of all working adults experienced mental health related disorders that they previously had not prior to the pandemic. The level of anxiety increased 4 times for the working professional compared to the pandemic. Early on in the pandemic, we were working in this crisis mode. We were working 15-hour days. Some of us are still working 15-hour days, and we were just exhausted. And when you're constantly going from experiments to experiments to experiments, or agile, that naturally has a cumulative effect of making you just exhausted of how do you actually continue on, which is what we're seeing now over the last 6 months, the results of which are the great resignation. And employees have said, I've had it. I'm tired. I don't want to do this anymore. There are other opportunities. Our research found that the most successful companies and the most successful teams were able to prioritize resilience, not necessarily at an individual level, but at a team level. So how do you make sure that your team is resilient and is able to cross the finish line together, as opposed to saying this is, you know, particular individual responsibility? The truth is, we come to the work world with different levels of resources. Some of us have more financial resources. Some of us have more personal resources, like family help. Some of us have more cognitive resources, etc. And it's natural that during the course of really intense experiments in an agile framework, your resources get depleted, right? And you constantly are exhausted. So what do we do when our phone battery is starting to die? Well, we plug it in. We let it rest. We have to charge up the battery. So in the world of resilience, it's really critical to figure out how do you first of all assess your team has enough energy to be able to solve that problem that you've tasked them to do? It's not an individual problem, a person's responsibility. It's everybody's responsibility on the team to make sure that we have enough team energy and team resilience to be able to solve this problem. And the different kinds of tools that you can use to be able to do that. Now, you might be familiar with, if you go to a big box retailer like Target or Best Buy, as you're walking out the store, sometimes they have a little stand with a bunch of happy faces that are different colored. Green, that you're very happy and you press that button, or you press red if you're unhappy. And the whole idea is to capture consumer sentiment and what it was like to be in that store. And so I want to use this analogy as a team leader at a startup or as a smaller organization or even a larger organization. You have to create something similar to understand how your team's energy and what their sentiment is. It's not enough for you to just make assumptions like we talked about earlier on. So you have to think about, how do I do this? Do I do this through a survey that I send out on a weekly basis? Or do I do this in a more informal way by making sure I'm asking everybody at a team meeting how we're feeling? But you have to have these kinds of personal, professional check-ins to think about, how is my team doing? And one really simple question to ask as a team leader to start this conversation is, what's sweet and what's sour in your life? We call this sweet and sour. So sweet is like something that's really good in your life right now that you really love, whether it's personal or work or social, whatever it is. And what's something that's a little bit sour, that's not working for you right now, that you need help with? The idea for this question is to open up a space at your team meeting to understand where people's energy levels are and where they need to have their energy resources refilled and supported by other people on the team. And it's just a great way to think about, how do we think about what is the right resilience level for the entire team to be able to make sure that we're solving the problem and it's not necessarily an individual's responsibility.
Yeah. And from that understanding of where they stand, I think you're able to embed a lot of things that can help not only the individual, but the team at large.
The other thing I'll say is that it's really critical for the person who is leading the team, whether, again, you're an entrepreneur, whether you're at a more established company, you have to role model the behavior that you want to see, right? You can't just ask people to say, how do you feel? You have to start out. You have to be vulnerable. You have to share how you feel so that that creates a space for other people to be able to talk about it. Now, some people may say, you know, I'm not comfortable doing this in a open environment. And that's fine too. Another way you can hack this is bring your team together. Let's assume your team is more than five people. You break them out into small Zoom rooms of, again, three people each. Create a little space for them to be able to talk in a more intimate environment. So people who might be a little bit more shy or introverted or less comfortable speaking in a large environment, they have the space to be able to say, I want to talk about this. This is how I feel today. And then open up a Google Doc, a shared Google Doc, where everybody can type in how they feel. It could be anonymous. It doesn't necessarily have to be names attached to it. But the idea is that you're capturing this idea, you're crowdsourcing literally how the team is feeling, even if you're doing it in a small Zoom room, so that you as a team leader can see, okay, this is the sentiment that I'm seeing in the team right now that we need to figure out how to adjust for or how to approach this in a different way.
No, and I love the point on the leader kind of being the first one that needs to make that shift or enact that change. And this is one of the core lessons in the five dysfunctions of a team. If you want to create a culture of vulnerability, the leader has to be the first one to be vulnerable and express that so that it can become permissible or acceptable or encouraged by others on the team. So love that. Cool. Finally, foresight.
Foresight. This is the ability to learn how to see around corners. Now, what I did for many years at the XPRIZE Foundation was we designed moonshot prizes to create new futures. You know, one of the things I love about Peter is that he says, I forget the exact quote, but the future is what you create it to be. And so how do you do that? And oftentimes people say, well, you can't predict the future. And that's true, because the future is uncertain. It's also in a multiverse. It could be different ways of happening. We're not quite sure how that exactly happened. The idea of foresight is that the most effective teams and companies are able to create a process that allows them to identify the early signals of change and be able to then create a plan, scenario plans that they can react to if that particular future state comes to fruition. Most companies are terrible at this, and they don't even have this. I think even the large companies, only 25% of them have foresight as any kind of executive experience on their leadership teams, because that's just not how they've been trained. And so I think it's really critical to develop this leadership skill set to help your team to be able to see around corners. And I'll give you a very simple methodology for doing that. It's really a three-step plan. One is you have to be able to detect changes. The second one is you have to be able to assess how important these changes are. The third one is to figure out what are the universe of scenarios that could happen if these changes were to come to fruition. Now, the whole point of foresight isn't to predict the future. It's to develop a skill set within your team that they're able to lead effectively when uncertainty hits, right? And so the whole idea of foresight is how do you detect the world of particular changes that might impact your organization? Very simple process. Task everybody on your team to identify one particular external threat that could impact your business, whether that's technology, whether that's economics or policy, whatever that is. And ask everybody on your team to identify one of those domains and then ask them to just track that over the course of a month, whether that's through social media or whether that's through the news, and then report back on a monthly meeting. Hey, what did you see in your particular domain that you think might have an externality that could impact our business, if in the short term or in the very long term? And then together as a team, you're going to decide, is this urgent? Is this something that has high likelihood of impact and high impact for our business? If so, then you want to say, of these particular signals that we've identified that could change our business, let's create a scenario that could be the case. Five different scenarios that if this particular technology were to come to fruition that would radically impact our business, what will we do in those situations? Just write a one-page scenario and what you would do in reaction. And the whole idea is to build that muscle to anticipate change and have the idea of your team being able to execute different ways of reacting in the event that the future changes. So that's what we mean by the world of foresight. It doesn't have to be a sophisticated operation. It's something that you can teach internally to your team right away so that, again, they're building that muscle for adaptability to live and thrive in a world of uncertainty.
Yeah, this one's so important, and it falls directly in line with Wayne Gretzky's famous quote that he says that he scored a lot of goals because he skated to where the puck was going, not where it had been. So I think this is the core tenet of that idea. And so, yeah, you want to detect changes, assess them, and then see what you're actually going to do about them. And I love the suggestion to kind of assign people different domains. You can even have people and assign them to specific technologies like, hey, keep up with everything happening in AI or Web3 or whatnot, and how we could leverage that, or what's happening in this space, or what our competitors are doing. One actually really cool example of how I implemented this with my recent startup, one of my team members embedded an RSS feed of Google Alerts for Web3, for Learn to Earn, for crypto, and that's embedded in our homepage of our Notion. So every time we open our Notion, we see like the top three articles or news pieces for those Google Alerts, and it's a great way for us to stay informed almost automatically. So
exactly. Love that.
Cool. Kian, we're getting to the end of it here, but final set of questions here on entrepreneurial lessons. So you've had the opportunity to work with a lot of Fortune 500 companies and startups. So I'm curious, like, what are some of the core mental barriers and limiting beliefs that you see show up the most with these people that startups and entrepreneurs can start to anticipate or deal with?
Well, I would say that most Fortune 500 companies, you know, are successful because they've been able to prioritize efficiency over innovation. They innovated a long time ago, they created a new product or service, and then the larger they got, they were able to scale. And in order to scale effectively, then they really focused on efficiency. And so that's why they're really good at the world of incremental innovation, right? And so they're really good at developing better product as they've already released it. They're less good at seeing around the corners and being able to use these disruptive trends to build new things. And part of that is because of the organizational structure that they're in. Again, it's hierarchical. It's really designed for maximizing efficiency rather than maximizing creativity and innovation. And so they are oftentimes in awe of working with entrepreneurs and startups who are doing the other things that they're not very good at. And so very often on Fortune 500 companies, and I know this because I've worked with over 50 of them, to help them learn about these kinds of technologies and startups, is that they want to see what's happening in this domain, and they want to know who are the startups that they can potentially learn from. They see this as a symbiotic relationship. They see it as a way for them to learn to not necessarily steal, I don't mean it that way, but sort of learn a mindset of what's possible. And so how are startups using new technologies to solve for X that this particular Fortune 500 company hadn't thought of before? They're very interested in that. And they're very interested in having those kinds of conversations. And then sometimes that can lead to doing a pilot for, if let's say a startup is building something that's directly relevant to that particular company, they're oftentimes open to doing a pilot and experimenting and seeing where that goes. One thing I would say is that for an entrepreneur to know that this opportunity exists, larger established companies are interested in partnering with startups and figuring out how they can solve for X and build something better together through a partnership. So don't be intimidated by, let's say, a large established company that is in the space that you might want to be in. See that as an opportunity rather than as a threat to figure out how you might partner with them. And don't be afraid to go out and have those kinds of conversations and create the pilot and try to actually do something together. The one thing to be aware of as an entrepreneur, though, is that, again, your resources are limited. You have a limited runway, and your timeline might be significantly different than what a larger established company's timeline is. And that mismatch in timelines can be very frustrating for entrepreneurs when they do partner with larger companies, because larger companies are slower and you may need to just solve for X extremely faster. One other recommendation I'd make is for entrepreneurs, when you're thinking about working with a larger established company, try to identify the CEO or the top leadership team who might be really open to this mindset, because the change of these larger companies really only happens if, again, the culture is set from the very top of innovation and really being open to it. If you're trying to start that conversation at sort of like the middle levels of the organization, you might find that process to be longer and a little bit more frustrating. So see if you can get an introduction to the CEO or somebody who is very senior at the organization, so you can kind of jump the shark a little bit and be able to actually get things faster. And in those situations, you'll find that the senior executives are very interested in these new technologies and collaborating with startups. And they're oftentimes open to actually going outside the established traditional methodology of processes that their organizations have put in place for innovation. And they say, okay, let's actually run with this as a Skunk Works project on the side. So really think about who you're trying to approach. And I would really try to approach the very top rather than trying to work your way up through, let's just say, a corporate innovation middle layer.
Yeah, that's great advice. How do you reach those people though? Cold email?
I mean, come on, you're an entrepreneur. You can hustle, right? Isn't that what entrepreneurship is? You call people, you text people, you email people, you show up where they're at, you go to conferences where they're at, you make yourself present. If you really care enough about it, then you'll figure out a way.
Yeah, I love this. What I really like about this is highlighting the point that this isn't a zero-sum game. There's opportunity for everyone and many people. The core thing is just to operate from the abundance mindset of collaboration rather than the scarcity mindset of competition. So really important. And yeah, one related question to this is like, what problems do you see these Fortune 500 companies experiencing that startups should be wary of from an early stage? Like what can they kind of like watch out for?
I mentioned this earlier, the different timelines. Their innovation timeline is different than oftentimes a startup's. So if you've got to solve for something in the next 6 months for your next round of funding, and this company is going to take 2 years to run a pilot with you, that's a total mismatch, right? So the sooner you know like how quickly they're able to move, the sooner you can decide whether you devote resources to solving for X or not with this particular partner. Really, really, really critical, this timeline. That, I think, is the most important thing. I think the mindset is there. These larger companies are definitely open to collaborating. It's just a matter of like how quickly can they do it versus how quickly you can do it. And if they're not on the same Venn diagram, that's when you're going to have problems.
Gotcha. Cool. Awesome. Final two questions for you, Kian. So let's say that you had the ability to send a voice message to every young entrepreneur across the planet. What concept, either related to life or entrepreneurship, would you teach these young entrepreneurs?
I would say people oftentimes think that they have to wait until they've made it successfully as an entrepreneur or as an executive, maybe towards the second afterlife when they start thinking about legacy. And I would actually urge you to think about your legacy now. What legacy are you starting to leave behind as a 20-year-old, as a 30-year-old, as a 40-year-old? Don't wait until when you think you've made it and arrived, then start giving back and thinking about that. How do you start building that legacy now? the more generous you are in terms of helping people you lift up to join the ranks that you are at, the more generosity, the more abundance you show, the more the universe will show that back to you.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And the core question I like to ask myself for that is, how do you want to be remembered? And that kind of gives you some characteristics of who you aspire to become and what you can aim for. So
absolutely.
Love that. Cool. So final question, Kian, what impact do you want to have in the invention of the future? How will you invent the future?
I'm hoping to invent the present. The future is multilinear and not particularly open, as we've talked about. I want to impact the present. And I hope that the research that we've done and the book that's coming out is going to change the mindset for people, how they work, and that they're able to radically shift towards a better mindset of work that allows more people to really thrive in this world that we live in. That's very, very different than it was the world prior to March 2020. And so I'm hoping right now I'm in the present. I try to be present because one thing that you'll never have again is time. And while I have aspirations for inventing the future, I always try to ground myself in the present. And right now, this is the gift that I'm trying to give to the world.
That's beautiful. Very unique and powerful answer. And I think the future is created by how we show up in the present. So well said. How can people learn more about you, the book that's coming out, and stay connected with what you're doing?
Yeah, definitely. I'm on Twitter. My handle is at from the KGB. On LinkedIn, you can Google the book on Amazon. You can type in my name. It'll just pop up right away. The book is called Competing in the New World of Work. It's coming out next month. It's actually Harvard's top post-pandemic research pick. And so we're really proud of all the effort that is going into it. You can learn more about the book at radicallyadapt.com. Again, it's radicallyadapt.com, and you can go and pre-order the book. You'll actually be able to get access to an 8-part video course that my co-author Keith Rozzi and I developed that's exclusively and free to you if you pre-order for the book. So I hope you take away lessons from it that will make you a radically adaptable entrepreneur and be able to really thrive in a world of uncertainty and future-proof your own career and your team.
Cool. Yeah, thank you for that. And I'll definitely include links for that in the show notes. Awesome, Kian. I appreciate your time. Very excited and bullish on the book and all the amazing things you'll continue to create and innovate in this world. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me, Julian. It's been a pleasure.
Cool. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And be infinite as always, and we'll catch you in the next episode. Hey guys, 3 quick footnotes here before closing off. So the first is, did you enjoy the topics discussed in this episode? Well, I invite you to join the Slack community for this podcast, where we'll keep the conversation going by engaging in discussions related to the episodes discussed in this podcast. Here, you'll be able to engage in conversations with me and other listeners. And if you really enjoy this podcast, it is likely that you would relate well with other listeners that also enjoy the podcast. In this community, you'll be able to meet, engage, learn from, and potentially collaborate with the like-minded entrepreneurs that listen to this podcast. Let's invent the future together. The second quick note is, if you are interested in receiving updates on new episodes, I invite you to subscribe to my newsletter. And in this newsletter, I'll also share notes, insights, wisdom, tools, and strategies that are designed to help you become a better entrepreneur and live a healthier, fulfilling, and more productive life. And finally, the last footnote is that you can follow us on social media accounts to get updates on new episodes and engage with invaluable content related to entrepreneurship. And also, we have a website now. You can go to inventingthefuture.ai for detailed show notes on all the episodes. So the links for joining the Slack community, subscribing to the newsletter, the social media accounts, and the website can all be found in the show notes for this episode. So with that, I would like to wish you a day, week, year, and life filled with an abundance of love, energy, and prosperity. Take care and stay infinite, my friends.